You're listening to MLB.com Extras, brought to you by MLB.tv. It's baseball everywhere.
Welcome to MLB.com Extras, the NL West. I am Alice Fitter from MLB.com. And as we look at the NL West, very interesting happenings, of course. The big news, Bud Black, the longtime manager of the Padres, dismissed from his managerial duties. And we will explore where the team goes from here. And the Dodgers and the Giants are both struggling, but they're doing it at the same time. And so neither team has really lost anything in the standings, which is probably good news for both of those teams. And in Arizona, a few personnel changes. Jeff Colmenter moving to the bullpen, and Paul Goldschmidt just being the all-star that he probably is destined to be again this year. So that is a quick look at the NL West. Welcome to MLB.com Extras, the Los Angeles Dodgers. Hello, everyone. I'm Allison Twitter here for my weekly chat with Ken Gernick. Ken, I wanted to start with this emergency landing that the charter flight had recently. Was that, were the players a little freaked out about that? They were headed from, I guess, San Diego to Arlington, and there was a mechanical issue. Did you talk to any players about, you know, if they were really scared when that was going on?
It wasn't an emergency landing. It was a diversion because of equipment trouble, but the Dodgers and United Airlines said it was not an emergency landing. So I'll clarify that. I think they were more annoyed at the inconvenience than anything. A couple of them just don't like to fly, so they're freaked out walking onto an airplane. So anything out of the ordinary would, just like they're human like a lot of people. A lot of people don't like to fly, so some of them don't either. But overall, it was, you know, a lot about nothing other than the fact that it was inconvenient and it took them an extra 4 hours to get where they were going. And so to that extent, they had to go through what a lot of us have to go through, and they usually don't because their ways pave pretty well, and airlines bend over backwards to make sure stuff like this doesn't happen to their prime clients like a professional baseball team, because they really don't like this kind of bad publicity, so they make sure they try to make sure it doesn't happen. But overall, you know, it just was an inconvenience more than anything.
Yeah, I just, my days of flying with the Astros, I mean, there were players that were, like you say, they're definitely afraid of flying. They had to take all kinds of stuff just to kind of knock them out and get them through those flights. So I would imagine that would be, you know, a little bit of a concern. But, okay, so I want to talk a little bit about the shortstop situation. We hear a lot about Corey Seager, and obviously he's the shortstop of the future, and eventually they want to bring him up. He's only 21 years old. I say this because Jimmy Rollins has been struggling mightily. So do you think that they would maybe bring him up this year? Is it too early for him?
Well, nobody knows. You know, it's a crystal ball question. I think one thing that that is a concern is that when they advanced him this year from AA to AAA, for 3 weeks he struggled. He hit 230. And so if he hit 230 in the jump from AA to AAA, what kind of adjustment will he make from AAA to the major leagues when this matters? You know, you're not doing it in front of 5,000 people with not a lot at stake. You're doing it with the pennant at stake. So I think that's part of the calculus here, is that, you know, is he ready at 21? Well, he struggled from AA to AAA. So it would make sense that he might struggle from AAA to the big leagues, and if that's the case, what do you do? Once you bench Jimmy Rollins or release him or whatever it is you're going to do with a former MVP as far as taking his job away, you know, you can't then turn to him a week or 2 weeks or 3 weeks later and say, well, you know, we made a mistake. It's your job again. That's probably not the way it's going to be handled. So I think when they take that job away, they've got to make sure that that it's permanent. And so then they have to make sure that the replacement is permanent, and you're talking about a 21-year-old who's already struggled once this year. Having said that, you know, clearly the job is going to be Seager's, you know, one day. And, you know, how long can the Dodgers go with a starting shortstop hitting 200? you know. And so it's a dilemma. Obviously, if it was an easy call, it would have been made already. So it's not. Like I said, it's a crystal ball kind of situation, and they have to make sure when they pull the trigger that that Seager's ready, and obviously they're not convinced of that yet, or they would have done it.
Right, and it makes it even more difficult when you're talking about a team that is going to be a contender all year and in the market that they play in. I mean, I'm sure that has to come into it. It's not like, a last-place team that they're sort of trying to maybe experiment with a couple different things. I mean, they have to make sure that they're not burying the kid before they even bring him up.
Right. You know, does he have no struggle? Does he struggle 3 weeks like he did, or does he struggle 3 months because it's a
right.
bigger jump? You know, and like you said, if he struggles 3 months, then what have you done to him? You know, he's 21, and you'd rather wait an extra week than call him up a week too soon, because sometimes that can't be reversed. You know, then he goes backwards, and you have to send him back down, and you're kind of starting all over again. So these are all part of the decision making, and I think that they're going to be, and to me, even though it doesn't really fill the position, I think they'll be more comfortable promoting Oliveira, the 30-year-old Cuban, because he's 30 years old and has played a lot of games, not in the big leagues, but a lot of games under pressure in Cuba, and he's close to coming up. And so, even though they don't really have the spot open like they do Rollins' shortstop spot for him, he's probably more advanced and more ready for that kind of promotion.
So the Dodgers have had, I was actually just talking with Chris Hatt about the Giants, and the Giants have been struggling lately. This is probably a good time for them because the Dodgers are also having some struggles. So both teams really haven't lost any ground in the standings, basically, because neither one is winning a whole lot. Dodgers really ran into a hot Rangers team, and everybody has been running into a hot Rangers team that has played them lately. So I guess they kind of, what's sort of the feeling now? It sounds like they're very frustrated, but at the same time, I guess these things kind of happen throughout the course of the season.
Well, I think that everybody got their expectations up probably too high in April when they were probably scoring too many runs over their head, more than they really should have been able to do, and now it's gone the other way, and now they're not scoring at all. So the truth is that they're probably somewhere in between, but it's been frustrating because it's been going on so long. So now I think that there's some doubt in their minds about how good of an offensive team they really are. They're almost back at full strength now. Carl Crawford is really the one starter that they don't have. But outside of that, they pretty much have their team offensively, and that's where they're struggling. You know, really most of their injuries now are in the bullpen. They've got five guys who've been hurt. So, that's no excuse for not being able to score, and they haven't scored. It wasn't just against Texas. They really haven't scored since May. And, the best thing that they've got going for them is that they're in a division that's very soft this year. And, one of the teams that they thought was going to be their biggest competition, San Diego, just fired their longtime manager. So that's a sign of how soft this division is playing this year.
Yeah. It is, and we thought it was going to be a really strong division, and it still could be, but there's a lot of teams that are struggling that we didn't think would. So, Ken, thanks so much. We will catch up with you next week.
Okay, Allison, thank you.
Here for my weekly chat with our intrepid reporter for the Giants on MLB.com, Chris Hatt. Chris, since we last talked, I guess this is a good time for the Giants to run into a few struggles because the Dodgers are also having their string of losses, so they're kind of canceling each other out, but that they just ended a very long losing streak at home, 9 straight, that ended on Tuesday with a win over Seattle. So that has to be a little disconcerting, as we've talked about many times. The Giants are very, very good at home, so I'm sure they hate losing at home. What was that whole thing like?
Yeah, they just didn't, at home, it's funny. They just didn't play, we've talked about it before. They just didn't play, quote-unquote, Giant baseball. They have to get back to doing that. And, right now, lately, with Madison, well, take Madison Bumgarner's last two starts. They pitch really well, but they don't score. Offense has definitely been a problem. I think tonight we're going to see Matt Duffy elevated in the batting order. Don't know it yet, but I wouldn't be surprised if he's somewhere in the top half of the order. I mean, he's got two hits last night off Felix Hernandez. Looks, you know, for a rookie, looks sharp at the plate. And they just have to find some source of offense, especially while Hunter Pence is out.
That's right. So I want to talk about this Madison Bumgarner start recently against the Mariners. So he had a no-hitter going for a while. And even Bruce Bochy said that he felt like he might actually get it. And then he said, oh, I hope I hadn't jinxed him with my thoughts on that. But as we know, there are no jinxes. What were you thinking? Did you think he was going to get that no-hitter?
I was thinking it was possible. You never, you know, I hate to sound like a player, but you never really think that stuff's going to happen. But it, you know, with him, it's, as I wrote, with him, it's an exception. I really think it's going to happen for him someday. And why not last night? Seattle's lineup isn't the strongest. But, you know, the statistics bear that out. And Madison was throwing these crackling fastballs and, you know, knee-bending breaking pitches. And it just looked like the stars were aligned for that sort of thing, possibly.
Well, does he know, though, that, like, the Giants only throw one no-hitter per season, so he actually has to wait until 2016?
That's just belief.
Okay, so,
oh, go ahead.
So now the Giants have an excess of starting pitchers, which is really kind of ironic considering how they started the season. Big Peavy seems to be coming back. Matt Cain maybe a starter or two away from coming back. They're not going to have a six-man rotation, so what happens?
Well, I really think we may see, you know, this is going to be a big outing. Ryan Vogelsong was scheduled to pitch the series finale against Seattle, and that a big outing for him. You know, he has pitched in the, you know, the emergency starter role before. They'd have no problem moving him back there. I don't see Chris Heston going back to the minor leagues, but, you know, it's all about, you know, managing your inventory, so to speak. And, you know, they might just have to do something like that with Heston while, you know, Cain and Petey reestablish themselves or Dole reestablish themselves. I think, you know, odds being what they are, one of them is not going to come back fully. I hate to be, you know, full of doom and gloom, but that's just the way things are. And, you know, maybe Chris Heston will end up, you know, staying in rotation, or Ryan Vogelsong. Who knows?
Yeah, I mean, often it's just so much of it is where guys are in contracts and options that they have on their contracts and the ability to be sent down to the minor league. And sometimes it's just cruel and unusual. I mean, not that Chris Heston, I mean, Chris Heston has had an up-and-down season, but, man, like, you know, a week and a half removed from a no-hitter or whatever it was to be options to AAA mainly because they can, that would be kind of brutal.
Because they can. That's a good phrase. That's right. Because they can. And you've seen it happen enough, Allison. You know, things have a way of working themselves out, and maybe something will happen, some combination of circumstances. I can't tell you what right now, but maybe he won't go down in the minors, and maybe Vogelsong will stay in rotation too. I mean, a lot of things are possible.
Right. Okay, let's talk about our friend Hunter Pence. I feel like I talk about him all the time. And mainly it's just that he's having a little bit of a hard time. So he had a setback in his rehab. Is that the latest, and what's going on with him?
Well, he's going to have to reapply a splint to that forearm if it's been bothered. So, I'm not saying it's back to square one, but it's you know, he's going to have to take things maybe a little slower here now with his rehab.
That doesn't sound like it's in Hunter's DNA, but I guess he'll have to slow it down a little bit in order to get back on the field. and I wanted to just end this on. This is a cool story. So, Marco Scudero, who we remember from 2012, and he's kind of had this iconic moment that he didn't even know he was having. I believe it was when the Giants were just about to clinch the pennant. He was standing in the outfield. It was raining on him, and he sort of, you know, having never been to the postseason, never been to a World Series, he was soaking it all up. He kind of became, you know, this sort of, I don't know, like an unsung hero of the Giants. And then he ran into some injury problems. He's never going to play again. So the Giants have signed him to a contract so that he can retire as a Giant. You see this happen with people who have been, like, with a team for their entire careers. It's symbolic, but that was a pretty cool thing for the Giants to do for Scudero.
It's a real nice thing, Allison. You know, they say there's no room for sentiment in this game, and maybe there isn't, but, you know, when push comes to shove, the Giants a lot of times do these sorts of things for their players. They, the Rob Mens, JT Snows, guys who meant more than just winning and losing, guys who transcended winning and losing. And Marco, just the way he played down the stretch and through the postseason in 2012, you know, was an inspirational type guy. He was a major reason they won the World Series. So this is a fitting tribute for him.
Yeah, I know that was an emotional thing for all of them when it kind of was discovered that he's talking, you know, that the injury was a career ender. And so a little bit of a happy ending, so good for them. Anyway, Chris, thanks so much. We will talk to you next week. We are joined by our special guest, Lyle Spencer, who is filling in for Corey Brock, who picked a really, really good time to take a week of vacation, although this was not pre-planned. But Lyle, let's talk. Obviously, there's only one thing to really talk about, and that is the dismissal of the Padres manager, Bud Black. This happened a few days ago, so we have all had a little bit of time to digest this. And so I guess what was your initial reaction when you heard about this? You've heard A.J. Preller's comments and just how this whole thing went down. What was your reaction?
Well, my initial reaction was, quite honestly, if Jock Peterson doesn't make the catch of the season the day before, I didn't see any way that this could have been done, because that would have meant they'd have won four of their previous six series, and the other two were splits. So it's not like this team, it seemed to be showing signs of moving in the direction that everyone had anticipated when they made all those winter moves. So the timing of it for me was a little odd, actually. I thought they had a chance to get it together, and I was hoping that Bud Black, after years of playing with, you know, diminished rosters, would have a longer opportunity to get this done. But I also understand, you know, management's thinking. They went out and made all these dramatic moves and made a huge investment, and it just hasn't really taken off the way they thought it would, and so it's always easier to unload the manager than to unload a roster.
Yeah, I find the thing that I think I had, I mean, I have all kinds of issues with this whole thing, including, you know, what we've been told by A.J. Preller. My issue is that it's made pretty public that they were thinking as early as last year, I mean, when A.J. took over, that Bud Black was not going to be there for the long term. He said on the record after the firing, we've been thinking about this for 2 weeks, thinking that Bud may not be the guy for next year. So it's almost like they were just like looking for this window of, okay, they lost the game, let's do it now, when this sort of seemed like it was in the works for a little bit longer, especially since he was not under contract past this year.
I agree with that. That's the way it appears, and who knows? You know, unfortunately, it's very common, not just in baseball, but in all businesses, really, when new people take charge, they seem to want their own kind of guy, or a guy they really think is best suited for the job. And change happens frequently when you have a whole overhaul in management. And it could be that Buddy Black, that it was as simple as that. And, you know, having been around, I covered the Padres for several years, and I'm familiar with the franchise and what's gone on. I actually thought in his tenure there, he did one of the best jobs of any manager in baseball, you know, being competitive year after year with a very low payroll and very few components of a winning operation in my mind. So I've always held him in the highest regard. So I need to preface everything here by saying that I've been around him since he was a great pitching coach for Angels team that won a World Series, and even as a player, I've just always held him in the highest regard, as does pretty much everyone in baseball. So yeah, I mean that's a lot of history there, and so, you know, naturally there's disappointment that this happened to a guy who is so well respected.
Yeah, and I think you hit it right on the head. I guess I kind of roll my eyes a little bit only because this is the same thing that we do here. I mean, there's a pattern with all organizations when you have like complete turnover in their front office and of management change, of ownership change. They just want their own guy in, and so I get a little, tired of hearing these talking points that are given when. I've experienced it here in Houston. Brad Mills was just, he had no shot, even though, Jeff Luna was saying all the right things until the day that they, fired him. And that just seems to be in the works the whole time. So that's, where, some of my cynicism comes from is just that we continue to, every time a manager gets fired, we continue to tell the story of these things that point to really the fact that it's probably been, in the plan the entire time. So I do want to talk about Pat Murphy. So now they had one manager for an interim until they got their interim manager in. So now we have Pat Murphy. And is he going to finish out the season? And what do you think beyond the season, does he have a chance?
Oh, yeah, I think he definitely has a chance. I mean, if he comes in and shows that he can gain the players' attention and respect and get this thing on the right track and turn it into a contender, absolutely, I think they'd like to keep him, because apparently, they have liked him from day one. I mean, that's the sense I have. He's done a really good job at AAA El Paso. He has a winning background in college baseball at Notre Dame and Arizona State. A lot of people think very highly of him as a motivator and as a baseball guy, a baseball lifer. I haven't heard a lot of negative things about Murphy. So he may prove to be the answer here. And for San Diego's sake, I hope he is. And it might have a happy ending for everybody. And that's what you hope for, because they do have a lot of quality pieces there. And that's why I felt it was just a matter of time before they iron out a few problems they had, defensively in the middle infield, and some issues with pitching staff. And those were things that were, I thought were fixable. As I mentioned, I was hoping Black would get a chance to carry it through, but that didn't happen. So now Murphy gets a shot.
Yeah, you do hear great things about him. You've heard great things about him for a long time. And for those of us that, sort of read a lot of stuff that maybe a lot of people aren't reading, but he's always had this very good reputation. You hear his name come up a lot. The pitching situation really is just sort of a head-scratcher, and it's just bitterly ironic that the one thing that they had, but that they thought they had pretty stable coming into the season, has actually been the source of a lot of instability as the season has gone on. So how do they fix this? Is there anything that they can put their finger on as far as why the starting staff hasn't really come together?
No, and that's the big surprise, because I really felt that rotation was going to be one of the best in the league, and even in baseball. I mean, it had the potential to be that. It's hard to explain how a guy with the stuff, let's say, of Andrew Cashner and Ian Kennedy cannot put together the kinds of starts consistently that you would anticipate. And Tyson Ross as well. And even James Shields has had some rough spots, even though on the whole he's been pretty much everything you could have wanted. And, he is, for me, I'll take him any day as a leader of a staff. He's what you want. He's a workhorse. He's a good person. He's good to, he's a good teammate. He's all those things. And even actually Craig Kimbrell, who in Atlanta was the best closer in the game, has been a little spotty. And so, it's hard to understand. If these guys had all delivered the way we thought they would, then, and not even mentioning Matt Kemp and his struggles. I mean, if those guys, the pitching, the rotation, and Kemp had performed anywhere near their old standards, this team would be right there. I mean, no question, they would be, pretty much neck and neck with the Dodgers and Giants in that division.
Yeah, I always sensed, even going into the season, I thought this could be a really good second-half team. This could be a little bit of a rough start because there were so many different pieces, and I thought these guys could really take off in the second half, and I think that could still happen regardless of who's managing them.
Well, right, and they were a really good second-half team last year with the worst offense in baseball. And so, that right. These are things that you know, I keep coming back to is, I just don't think anybody could have done a better job over the past 9 years in black.
Yeah, no, I agree. And I think that this could be the shortest unemployment for a fired manager in the history of baseball. I just don't see him being out for very long because, I don't know what manager jobs are going to be open or anything like that, but I just sense that people are going to be licking their chops trying to get Buddy Block to maybe be interested in them.
Well, yeah, I mean, if he wants to stay in it, I mean, I think a team in need of a really stable, knowledgeable, proven guy would be crazy not to look into Buddy Black.
Yeah. Well, we'll wish him the best and sort of the Padres the best. But, Lyle, thank you so much for pinch hitting for us, and we will be knocking on your door, I'm sure, at some point this season. Thank you so much.
It's always a pleasure, Allison. Thank you.
Here for one of the highlights of my week is my weekly chat with Steve Gilbert, covers the Diamondbacks for our Fearless website. And Steve, I want to talk about happy things, at least to start off. And so I want to talk about Paul Goldschmidt because, like a teammate recently said, Goldie does Goldie things. Let's just read some of these statistics. A 363 average, reached base in 27 straight games, that has 19 homers on the year. So how amazing is he, and what kind of year is this for him?
You know, it is. It's an amazing year that he's putting together at the plate, and it's one of those things where, you know, guys get hot at times during the year, but he's just been this way almost from the first day of the season. So he has an amazing ability to take the same approach every day. He goes through the same routine every day. And he focuses more on having good at-bats than the actual results of the at-bats. You know, he told us after a big game at Miller Park a couple weeks ago that, you know, well, there was a couple balls that fell just inside the line, and if those don't fall inside the line, now I'm hitting with two strikes, and who knows, things could be different. So he tries to keep the results out of it and just focus on the process, and that seems to be an approach that obviously is working very well for him.
And it's really cool that he seems to be he is a leader. So he has, like, all of the necessary requirements to really be, like, a star of a team. He seems to kind of bring people together, and he knows what the team means. He knows what to say publicly. He seems to be, like, the total package.
Yeah, you know, he is great in terms of making himself available to the media when we need things. And if you want to ask him about any one of his teammates, he's more than happy. He'll give you great stuff on his teammates. It's just when you try to ask him about himself, he's so humble that he just he tries to deflect the attention and the credit to everybody else. So if he hits a big home run in a game, and you ask him about it, he'll tell you about the guys that got on base in front of him that really made a difference, or maybe the guy in front of him struck out and saw 8 pitches, and so he'll find ways to give credit to other people. So he really is, in that sense, a leader. And he, as he's getting more experience and more years in the big leagues, he's becoming more of a vocal leader with the guys as well.
So as we are recording this, and I believe that the series finale with the Angels is while we are actually talking, but they've won 5 of 6, swept San Francisco, which is not easy to do. Took 2 of 3. So there's a home-and-home series with the Angels and 1, 2 of 3 heading into the final game. So my point being that this is a nice little stretch. They're a game under 500, but really much better than last year, much better than what the expectations were coming into the season. What has been, would you say, if you had to pinpoint, like, one thing that's really been the biggest contributor, is it, like, the offense?
Well, I think overall the offense has been a strength of theirs during the season. I think this recent stretch that they're on, the starting pitching has kind of come around, and that was obviously their biggest Achilles heel when the season started, and one of the things that kind of hurt them early on in the year with the starters not pitching deep in games, and they had was kind of taxing the bullpen a bit. But now that the starters have started to pitch extremely well, it allows the offense to relax, and you've kind of seen that now with this little stretch that you referenced when they're starting to play some much better baseball.
I hear great things about A.J. Pollock. We don't hear a lot about him, you know, maybe outside of the Diamondbacks territory, but as a center fielder, I mean, you just hear that he's up there with among the best. What kind of player is he?
He is, you know, like you said, defensively, he's got to be, if not the best, one of the best center fielders in the National League. Outstanding defensively, and at the plate, he's really started to put it together, and he actually kind of started to do that last year before he suffered an injury that robbed him of significant playing time, and it was a little harder for him to kind of get back in rhythm when he came back. But he's got a little bit of pop. He gets on base. He's a fun player to watch. He's very fundamentally sound. He's the kind of guy that maybe if you look at his tools outside of defense, nothing will grade as, you know, plus-plus, but everything will grade as at least average, if not above average, in all those areas, which makes him a very valuable player.
So one final talking point here. I think that after our last conversation, soon after that, Josh Coleman was moved to the bullpen. So our last conversation, we were trying to figure out what's happening with him. And then this came out. So what are they hoping? Have they figured out that maybe he's, like, not quite a starter? Or it seems like he's a little bit less on his velocity, and maybe he's just been better with the bullpen? Or is this a chance for him to sort of get his act together and maybe rejoin the rotation?
I think for right now they're not looking at it as a temporary thing. I think they just want him to get in there and put him back in a role that he's had a lot of success in the last few years. And Alan Webster, who stepped in for him, pitched really well in his first start and pitching well again today so far. So I think for Josh right now they're looking at him more as maybe he is a better fit in the bullpen, and maybe he can be that guy that's been the last couple of years where he saves the bullpen when the starter gets knocked out early, or if they need a spot start or whatever. He's kind of a jack of all trades down there, and maybe that's where his best value would be for the team right now.
Interesting. Just the fact that he pitched on opening day and then this has come. I mean, that's got to be a rarity for the opening day starter to be, you know, moved to the bullpen at any point.
Yeah, you know,
especially this early.
Yeah, Josh has always talked about the fact that he moved from the rotation to the bullpen and then back. You know, he always said during spring training, most guys don't get the opportunity then once they're moved to the bullpen to come back. And so he said it's been more of a revolving door than a one-way street for him. And I guess he's right, because the revolving door has spun around again, and he's back in the bullpen.
Okay. Very interesting. Well, thanks, Steve, very much. We'll talk to you next week.
Allison, my pleasure.
This is a very big treat, everybody. I'm Allison Footer from MLB.com, and I'm here live and in person, and we've been looking forward to this for many, many, many weeks. Oh, wait. Right now, we're actually taking a selfie as we are recording this. Okay, 1, 2, 3. Cheese. Okay, so I'm here with Thomas Harding, who is traveling with the Rockies, and he's in Houston, Texas, where I live, and so we are standing here looking at each other and having this conversation. So, Thomas, how are you?
I feel good. I feel clean. I am so happy to see you. So happy to see you.
I am happy to see you, too. So let's talk about the Rockies, who are kind of up and down and here and there, but one very steady person in this organization this year and throughout his career is Jorge De La Rosa, who recently became the franchise leader with 73 career wins, which surpasses Aaron Cook. So that is a significant thing for a Rockies pitcher to have longevity in the organization and to have this kind of success.
Yes, and he did it without growing up in the organization. He bounced around with several organizations, the Diamondbacks, the Red Sox, the Brewers, before getting here. He even pitched a little bit in the Mexican League. But he found a home in Denver, and not only that, but twice he has re-upped signing contracts with them. That is really rare for a guy to come here from other places and love it and stay. But I'll tell you what, the Rockies really unlocked a lot of potential with him. Bob Apodaca, the pitching coach, he had some familiarity with him in Milwaukee, and I think he was able to get some things out of him. He knew him pretty well. And also, they had a sports psychologist who's no longer with them, Ron Spetich, and what he did was talk to him about just the mental control on the mound, and he would sometimes lose his temper during games. Well, Jorge had always wanted that type of training. But the problem was all that stuff was in English. And, you know, he grew up in Mexico. And while he speaks English well, it's his second language. Now, at one point, his wife looked at all of the materials and translated them to English. And
really?
Jorge was able to develop, hey, this will work for me, the stepping back, the breathing exercises. And he really started to take off about his second year in the organization.
Wow. Okay, so do they do this with any other pitchers? I mean, is this a regular practice with some other guys?
Yeah, they do it all throughout the minor league system. There's a new gentleman who's working with the guys, Andy McKay. He is working with some of the pitchers who have been up in the majors and also throughout the minor league system. But back then, it was a guy named Ron Svedich, and he was brought in by Clint Hurdle. Clint actually had him travel with the team for one season just to try to look and see if there are different things that could be done about the home road performance issue. But those things work, and I think every organization does it. Some organizations talk about it more than others, but it's my understanding that just about everyone has that type of person.
Interesting. And also, I mean, he's De La Rosa. He's not just stumbled into these wins by luck. 4-0 with a .256 in his last five games. So he's actually pitching really well.
Yes, and I think we talked about it early when he was injured during spring training. Last year, he got off to a horrible start. He was actually feeling too good. And he got off to a horrible start, and when his thumb started hurting and his back started hurting, he really pitched well. He tends to struggle early, but usually there's something going on with him physically, and that's when he pitches at his best. So he says that it helps him not feeling 100% because it just makes him focus mentally.
Interesting. Okay, so let's talk about some other good performers. Troy Tulowitzki, so of course, it's kind of what we expect from him, but we can keep the accolades on him a little bit because since May 29th, entering this game that we are about to watch between the Rockies and the Astros, this is being recorded on Tuesday. Today is Tuesday, yes. Hitting .407 since May 29th, hitting safely in 13 of 14 games. So he's kind of rolling, and he's the same old Tulo that we're used to.
Yes, and usually that happens when a guy is still in the prime of his career and he struggles a bit. Usually you expect it to happen at some point. With him, he wasn't seeing breaking pitches out of the pitcher's hands, and you could tell because he was missing the same pitch from right-handers that he was missing from left-handers, and it was the breaking ball that was either down and in and down and away. Once he got that situated, he's been able to hit. And what you're going to see, especially when he turns hot, is not only as counts go does he hit the ball hard, but he will jump on some pitches early in counts, especially if pitchers are feeling, hey, I can't get him to chase my curveball or my slider, let me try to sneak a fastball by him. That's where he excels. He's one of the best first pitch hitters in the game. So you're starting to see all of it come into play for him.
And is this an obvious question, but is he the all-star? I mean, we're entering the period of where the all-star team is sort of maybe taking shape a little bit, and would he be the Rockies representative in the all-star game?
I don't really think so.
Really?
And I'll tell you why. Because of the years that Nolan Arenado and DJ LeMahieu are having offensively and defensively. I mean, it would be hard to send a team that's in the bottom of the division three guys to the all-star game.
Right.
And right now I see, from a consistency standpoint, DJ and Nolan ahead of him. Now, if he continues to go crazy, he could end up in the All-Star game because of the reputation and the ability that he's shown over a number of years. And if you want to pick the most talented shortstop, it would be hard not to pick him. But when I watch the performance this year, I think that DJ LeMahieu and Nolan Arenado deserve to go to the All-Star game first on my ballot.
Okay, so now we need to talk about what is going on in American League voting. And this is, I don't know that anybody can really figure this out. Okay, so I have what I'm referring to is the fact that the Kansas City Royals are basically dominating at every position in voting, which means that the Kansas City fans are voting in droves. This is the first year that they have not had paper balloting and in-stadium balloting, so it's all online. And there have been some recent articles that have come out that our fearless leader, Mr. Bob Bowman, who runs the operation at MLB.com, says that there is nothing funny going on as far as from a technology standpoint and where the votes, or there's something coming out of Kansas City, everything like that. So What do you think about that and the fact that, you know, there, I mean, the Royals who run the AL pennant, so there are a lot of very deserving guys to go to the All-Star game, but not the entire starting lineup, and that's what's happening. So what do you make of all this?
First of all, this is a fan voting contest. Fans love their guys. Let them vote. Let me ask you a question here and to the people who think this is a total travesty. There are years that Boston Red Sox or New York Yankees go to the All-Star games that probably there's someone in a smaller market who deserves to go over them. I mean, the Kansas City Royals, they went to the World Series last year, and people act like those guys just snuck into someone else's party. It's almost as if a lot of the small market teams are here just to give the Yankees and the Red Sox and the Dodgers and the Giants somebody to play against. So if their fans want to stand up and say, hey, wait a minute, we want to be heard, we don't want to be ignored out there, then I am more than happy for them. I mean, I've known some Kansas City Royals fans, and they love that team. They remind me a lot of the Pittsburgh Pirates, a team that I grew up following, also the Cincinnati Reds, where they have very loyal fan bases. But and in the past, when they were really successful, you just talked about their fan bases. Now they are small market teams, and they're sort of shunted aside. So if the Kansas City Royals have more computers than other people, or they know people that are more computer savvy, or their fans love MLB.com more than I love them, so I don't have a problem with at all.
Even some of the guys that like don't have the numbers to be all-stars that could not just end up all-stars, but in the starting lineup, you're okay with that?
I'm okay with it because I don't know that the All-Star game should be determining who's at home in the World Series
to begin
with.
Yes.
I don't believe that to be the case.
Right.
It's an exhibition, and it's a fun exhibition. And if it's an exhibition that baseball fans, you know, want to see, then let them vote. Don't rip it out. I remember hearing about it. I'm not old enough. I'm pretty old, but not old enough to remember the ballot stuffing in Cincinnati where there were some players whose, I think their reputations were almost sullied by the commissioner pulling them out of the All-Star game. You know, I'm not crazy about that. Gus Bell, father of Buddy Bell, one of the great families in baseball. This guy's not an All-Star. There's one guy who overrules the fans and says, this guy's not an All-Star. Let the fans do what they do, and if another team can find a way to get all their people in front of the computer, then hey, have parties, have all night parties voting for your guys.
Yeah, I mean, you make good points. I was very much in favor of the in-stadium balloting going away, first of all, because it's a tremendous waste of resources and trees, but also because I felt like the teams that drew well had more of an advantage and were able to sneak guys in that maybe weren't as deserving as some of the guys who play for teams that don't really draw well. But when I see what's happening now, I find that, I don't know, they might have to make some adjustments, even though it won't be bringing back in-stadium balloting necessarily.
Well, but it goes on in the stadium. I mean, I've seen at Coors Field where they have little voting booths where people can sit there and plug in their Rockies and vote for those guys. I mean, let's face it, when you have fan balloting, there's going to be a certain number of fans who are going to look at all of the stats, and I'm sure there are some who have all their sabermetric charts and the war and peace or whatever the signs are, whatever the acronyms are, and vote for their guys. So if somebody says, you know, I really love so-and-so, then that's fine. It's like, I remember when I was little, there was a utility guy. He actually was a one-time All-Star named Tony Taylor. And the fact that he played for a whole bunch of teams and almost every position, I was fascinated by him. I would, you know, write his name in on the All-Star ballot for whoever he was playing for, the Phillies or the Tigers or whatever. I don't have a problem with fans attaching themselves to players. I mean, maybe the Royals can use this to their betterment. Hey, our fans really love us. Let's do something to make sure we stay in that World Series.
Yeah, well, when I was a kid, I would take the bunch of ballots and I would just vote for Paul O'Neill, like, you know, 20 times. But then I would stop after 20. I'd, you know, go back to, like, doing what I was doing before, whether it was watching a baseball game or just living my life. I didn't sit and, you know, have 200 ballots of Paul O'Neill. I was like, yeah, 20.
Yeah, you can do 20 pretty quickly. I mean, yeah, those punch-out ballots, I would punch-out ballots. And I'm like, wait a second here. I need to go out and throw some, you know, throw a ball against the wall and practice diving catches in the streets. That was what I did. So.
Yeah, it had nothing to do with Paul O'Neill being a great player, which he was, but he was really cute. So that's why I voted for him. You know, that was it.
You know, I don't even know if Tony Taylor was cute, and I don't think I care, but I want you to look at the pictures and tell me next time, Tony Taylor, cute, not cute.
I'm going to Google him as soon as we're done here.
Okay.
So, okay, Thomas, thank you so much. This has been highly entertaining, as I anticipated, so please come by a little more often if you can.
Well, I'd love to. Have the schedule maker schedule us more. I mean, they took Houston from our league.
I know.
You know?
I know.
I've got to say something about that Houston Astros team out there.
Okay.
They're exciting.
Yes.
They're dynamic. They're athletic.
Mm-hmm.
I see them, and I'm wondering, is that where the Rockies are headed? That's where they need to be headed. And the other thing about the Houston Astros is, in the last couple of years, they've gone back to blue and orange. I love it. They look
yes.
like the Houston Astros. It's not like they're trying to blend in as the Arizona Diamondbacks. I mean,
right.
they look downright Enos Cabellian.
Yes. Enos Cabellian, I like
yes.
that word. No, you're right, and hopefully they are going to stick with this color scheme until the end of time.
Yes,
even if they change up the logos and do things for a marketing standpoint, but it would be nice because those are representative of the Houston Astros.
No doubt about it.
Thank you, Thomas, very much. We will talk to you next week.
Thank you for listening to MLB.com Extras, the NL West.